wonderful morning we've had already. I always enjoy musicians like Carolyn and Beth who are willing to fully dive in and embrace the theme. That first song on simplicity was beautiful. I love that. Carolyn, by the way, was recently voted the musician most likely to accompany you into the apocalypse because she can make almost anything sound good. She could find a tin can, come up with some kind of a unique South African name for it, and then, like, you know, twiddle with it, and she's got an instrument. I'm constantly amazed at the menagerie of various instruments that you bring. It's always so much fun to have you in. Wayne, thank you for that wonderful meditation, especially ending it with our friend Rumi. I do think of him as a friend. We're in this series called Quiet Practices for Loud Times. Last week we talked about silence. So did anybody have an opportunity to practice any intentional silence last week? Show of hands.
Okay,
wonderful. Is my mic on? Let's see here. Let's try that. Does that help? Is that... I'm gonna. Okay, now I'm on. Am I good? Okay. All right. Sorry about that. It's a 50-50 shot on this microphone. There's an on or an off, and I thought I had it pointed in the right direction. My apologies. Where was I at? Where were we talking? Silence. How did we do? Silence. Was it challenging? Interesting? Some shared in pre-talk, you know, that it was kind of refreshing, resetting. And these practices are opportunities to prepare us to receive more. We don't engage with silence by way of deprivation to punish ourselves, even though sometimes silence can feel very punishing to our psyche. We engage with silence because silence is the fertile ground out of which insights are born. And if we don't ever allow the space for silence, we neglect to prepare the canvas for the painting. Anybody who's ever done any type of oils or other types of watercolor paintings knows that there's the art process, but especially if you get into oils, preparing the canvas is very, very important. I learned from the, not directly, but just secondhand from the illustrious Bob Ross, from a certified Bob Ross instructor. And when we would prepare the canvas, there were a number of different techniques that we could do that would create a base out of which the painting could emerge. And that was an essential process. So that's how we're thinking about things like silence. And then this week we're talking about simplicity, about simplifying. This is something that we tend to do naturally as we get older. Also, by way of a little quick rabbit trail, also as we get older, we tend to have midlife crises. And this past week, I had one that was spectacular. I went roller skating again for the first time in a long time. Two nights ago at Terry Hall Roller Rink in Grand Rapids. Anybody been? Fantastic. It was so fun. If you want to reignite the nostalgia of being a young person on the rink with the music pounding, and they were playing only the best, like, wedding bangers at a reception in the early 2000s, like that kind of music. It was spectacular. But simplicity, simplifying our life. We're combating the cult of more that tells us that we need more things in our life. And chances are, by this point in your life, you have come to see through the illusion that accumulating more things makes you happier. And perhaps maybe your more is in your calendar, or as somebody pointed out this morning, their inbox created that sense of stress for them, like there was just so much happening. Lao Tzu said, to manifest simplicity, to manifest plainness, to embrace simplicity. He says, manifest plainness, embrace simplicity. So this week, this core idea is that the quiet that we use to create this fertile ground from which to grow, that quiet gets easier when our life is less crowded. And what we're reducing is our clutter and our commitments. And ultimately, the word that I want to kind of use to latch on to that helped me kind of come up to terms with this concept was we're reducing friction in our lives. So any engineers in the room, your ears may perk up at the idea of friction. You may be familiar with engineering principles on how to reduce friction in complex systems. I'm not an engineer or a builder, but I come from a software type background, a creative arts background. So as a software engineer, I'm very familiar with the fact that good code is simple code, and that what differentiates an average coder from a really skilled developer is the ability to write code that can do the same thing but with less lines, because less code loads quicker, is more efficient, runs better. So from a software engineering perspective, reducing friction means taking out anything that is not necessary from achieving that goal and trying to do it in as few steps as possible. When I was probably in my early 19 to my early 20s, for a year or two, I had a stint as this job where I would film videos for this guy who did something called rapid process redesign. And specifically, he had a niche with medical institutions, ER units, and he would go into an ER, and the staff would all have like kind of a off-site or an on-site weekend. And they would take a board with sticky notes and identify every single process from a person walking in the door of the ER, going through the check-in process, to them getting into the bed, timing it, and then looking at that process all at once. And then the process redesign happens when, in a single weekend, they would get together, put their heads together, and find simpler ways of doing things, removing redundancies and saying, well, why should this take 18 minutes when we can do it in 6? This process is unnecessary. If we have them fill out the form here, and then they found ways to do that, and in a single weekend, they could save costs, save time, and perhaps even save lives through this redesign of systems. Looking at these points of friction and saying, where are the things that we can eliminate? So that's my question for you is, where is your life dragging right now? Where are you experiencing drag? Simplicity starts by paying attention to friction, the places in our life that grind or snag or require a little too much effort. When I'm thinking about friction, I couldn't help but think of something that's very of the moment. Of course, the Olympics, the Winter Olympics are happening right now. And probably one of my favorite sports, tell me if I have any other fans in here, is curling. Curling is a fascinating sport. On top of the fact that, did you know every single curling stone is harvested from one single island in Scotland? It's a specific type of granite, extremely pricey. That, I digress. There's so many fascinating things about it. But one of the best sports and one of the best team members on the sport are those guys and gals on the team with those brooms, right? You know, can do the really slow sweep, and then the captain's down there yelling at them, and they're sweeping away and sweeping like their lives depend on it. What they're doing, of course, is they're reducing friction. And when they reduce the friction, the stone can move faster. And it's this complicated dance between having just the right amount of friction so that the stone gets to where you want it to go. It's a truly amazing sport, and that's what I thought about when I'm thinking about this idea of reducing friction in our life. So if engineers aim to reduce friction in complex systems, and software engineers try to develop code that is efficient as possible, What does it look like to apply to our lives that same sense of curiosity and attention? Friction is the hidden tax on your energy. It's the stuff that makes everything take longer than it should. The term in cars is a phantom drain. I once had a black Mustang that I loved, but I should have just taken a little bit longer and inspected it before I bought it off the lot. Turns out that the aftermarket stereo unit in there was installed probably improperly and had a phantom drain on the battery. And to fix it, I was getting quotes of $1,000 or more. It was complicated. And it was easier for me to just do something that I'm kind of ashamed to say. I was an early adopter to electric cars because every time I pulled the vehicle into the garage, I had to hook up a battery charger to it because the phantom drain from that stereo unit improperly installed would, in the morning, I'd go out there and if I go to start, my battery's dead. And I did that the entire time I had the car. It was stupid, and I was glad to be done with that feature of the car. But there are things in our life that are kind of like that phantom drain. Things that drain us in the background without us even realizing or recognizing that it's happening. We're embracing simplicity in the face, or as an antidote to this chaos, to this complexity. Simplicity is about reducing friction. I'll go on one more little mini rant before I go on to my second point, because I had a very real sense of chuckling to myself as I went to go print out my notes in the office this morning. You may not realize it, your giving records are probably more secure than like the vaults at Fort Knox. To get into the office, first of all, there is a key, an external key. This is the only key I've gotten, and I was able to make it copied, and mine has a little devil face on it, which I thought was funny. So the outside door has a key, and then you come inside, and you immediately have a code, a 4 or 5-digit code, D-D-D-D, then the alarm goes off, okay? Next step, now you're walking down the hallway. At the end of the hallway is a door, and it also has a separate code. And so you enter that, and then now you're to the interior, inner sanctum of the office, but you're not in yet. There is one last door, and yes, one last key, but that key is inside of a lockbox, which of course has another 4-digit code. I kid you not. This is how long it took to get in. The whole time I'm humming Mission Impossible theme, dun, 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 dun. And once you do the 4-digit code in the lockbox, you can open it up, then you get the key out. The second key, now you can unlock the door, and then you're in. Now, there are also filing cabinets inside that I don't even have keys to, so that would be even one more key and layer of security. That's the opposite of simplicity. This is not what we're striving for. But I suppose that it's, I wouldn't say it's necessary, but it is humorous every time we do it. Our minds aren't built for infinite options and choices. Our brains love clarity because it's efficient. Our brains crave simplicity. Our brains try to categorize as a way of reducing cognitive load that comes from too many choices. Our brain, like a computer that's overloaded, running too many programs, our brain can in the same way get overtaxed by too many things, too many demands. And too many inputs and options create this cognitive load and leads to decision fatigue. In a famous study, there were two different display shelves set up of jams and jellies. One had a market that had 24 jams in a display, and then shortly next to it was another display that had only 6 jams. Now, the initial display of the 24 jams garnered more initial attention. More people went to that, but ultimately, people were 6 times more likely, 10 times more likely to select a jam from the display of 6 than from the display with 24. And those who bought the jam from the display with only 6 options were actually happier with their choice than the ones who selected from the availability of 24. We mistakenly buy into the capitalist idea that more is better and more options is better for the economy. But if you've went shopping and tried to select a breakfast cereal in the breakfast cereal aisle of a grocery store, the sheer number of choices that have multiplied in recent years, and that's just in the grocery store. We now have so many avenues with which information assaults us. Ben Schwartz, who wrote The Paradox of Choice, Why More is Less, he said, learning to choose is hard, learning to choose well is harder, and learning to choose well in a world of unlimited possibilities is harder still and perhaps too hard. When we are given more options, it can be difficult to evaluate each different one. It requires more time, more cognitive effort on our part, and it can lead to more anxiety, more worry. Simplicity isn't about becoming a minimalist monk. It's not about reducing to the point of extremism, but it is about reducing tiny decisions that steal away your best attention. It's about reducing the friction in your life that can better lead you to more. In The Power of Less, Leo says, I advocate single tasking as opposed to multitasking. Single tasking, focusing on one task at a time. Working as simply as possible to preserve your mental health and to improve your effectiveness. He says, multitasking can be crazy-making, and in this already chaotic world, we need to rein in the terror, find a little oasis of sanity and calm. In our series that we just were last in last year, and I promise that we're going to come back to it, we were originally slating to the Digital Empire series that we were in. We were going to originally come back for part two in February, and given the kind of the heaviness of life in the year, we kind of like bumped that one out a little bit. So we're going to come back to part two on that. But at the very end, you may remember one of the books and the authors I was quoting a lot was Cal Newport. And he wrote a book called Digital Minimalism. And I know several of you have actually read or picked up that book. That was one of the resources. And it is such a wonderful example of what simplicity in the area of our digital consumption can look like. He says digital minimalism, he defines it this way, as this philosophy or this technology, a philosophy of technology use in which you focus your online time on a small number of carefully selected and optimized activities that strongly support things you value and then happily miss out on everything else. It's a targeted approach to your online consumption. It can take the form of setting time limits on your device, on your computer. It can mean reducing the clutter of your screens, of your inbox. It can look all sorts of ways. But when you look at your life and you ask the question, where do I experience the most friction? That may be the indication of where you need to invest some time to actually move to a state where in this digital empire that we live in, learning to see new technologies as tools to support things that we value, not as sources of value in themselves, right? Our email is a wonderful technology that allows us to be connected to people all around the world, but it is a tool to support things that I value in life. And when it begins to reduce my time to allow me to spend time in the things that I value, that becomes a point of friction. That's where we take simple steps to mediate and simplify our lives. So this outer clutter, if you will, can lead to more inner noise. As we talked last week about silence, we are, of course, not simply talking about just simply the absence of sound, but creating space in our lives. And simplicity gives us the ability to expand our space so that our life is not so crowded. It gives us that breathing room that we need. Life can often feel very, very complicated and overwhelming due to its complexity. Simplicity acts in some ways like a lens. We've used this metaphor before. Simplicity acts like a lens, reframing the chaos of the world into something manageable. Instead of having the entire world and all of the dumpster fire that this world has turned into in the day-to-day news, if you listen to and consume that, instead of having that wide angle, wide aperture thing that lets everything in, simplicity reduces the aperture, not with a ostrich head in the sand approach. We're not ignoring all of that, but we are choosing to reduce our area of focus on the things that support the things that we value and not allow these extra things to steal attention and time. Hans Hoffman, this is probably one of my favorite quotes that I stumbled across, and I've been really thinking about this. The ability to simplify means to eliminate the unnecessary so that the necessary may speak. Simplifying is eliminating the unnecessary so that I have more time, more space, more attention for the things that I value, for the things that are essential. When we simplify, our minds become less cluttered, allowing for fresh perspectives, for innovative ways of thinking. Anybody who has experienced the magical healing power of a good night's rest or even a good nap knows how that forced reset, that forced shutting down, is such an essential part of our well-being. I forget whoever introduced the series last week said that this is really tied to our value at C3 of well-being. And it is true. Our well-being can inflate or deflate. It can go up or down depending on how much we fill our lives, by how much we allow in. And there are times in life where we have to just say, stop, enough is enough. One forced or realized transition that somebody mentioned this morning is moving. Anybody who's moved houses or apartments recognizes the innate drive to simplify when you go through that process. It's natural. You start to declutter, you start to give things away, and you make all these trips to the local Goodwill. It's that simplification that comes from seeing all your stuff. So simplicity at its core is about stripping away distractions and focusing on what truly matters. We're coming up on a season that, to be honest, I used to enjoy. It was one of the last religious practices that I sort of let go of, and it's hard to embrace it now based on what it means, but I love the practice, and that's the practice of Lent. Has anyone undergone a season of Lent intentionally that wasn't forced on you by your parents or Catholic school you were in? I wasn't raised Catholic, but yet I came to Lent as an outside evangelical who embraced that practice because I love the practice of picking something in your life to remove for a season. And anytime I used to teach about Lent and the season of Lent and this practice, my refrain always was, Lent isn't about scarcity, taking something away. If you're focusing on what you are taking away from your life for a season, you're already missing the point, okay? If you're skipping sugar and coffee or something like that, and you're like, oh, that's just a New Year's resolution, right? But it's about removing something in your life so that you can prepare yourself for more. Lent is a season of abundance, not scarcity. You pick something from your life to pull out almost like a weed, weeding a garden so that the right things can grow. That's what simplicity does. And remember, this is about approaching our life with curiosity and not judgment. It is so, so important that you hear me say that because it's very easy to turn this into kind of a self-help TED Talk, here's how to declutter your life and be happier in 30 days thing. I don't want you to get down on yourself because of how many things you have. I don't want you to get into your car in the drive home and get mad at yourself and berate yourself for how out of control your car is or your closet. If that's what you're taking away, you're missing it, okay? I hope for you that these become opportunities to approach your life with curiosity, not judgment. To look at the way you're living with a almost Buddhist detached mindfulness, if that makes sense. You're detached, you're stepping almost as if you are an outsider observing your life. And you're approaching it with curiosity. You're not listening to negative self-talk that tells you you should be doing more, that your life would be so much better if this and this. Our lives go through seasons, and life is complex. But simplicity creates room and space so that the essential things can grow. I read a book this past week in just a few days because it was relatively short. I did the audiobook version. It was read by the author. It's called The Year of Less by Kate Flanders. I don't know if anybody's read that. It's maybe 10, 12 years old. She writes about this practice that she undertakes that involved a shopping ban. She had these lists of things she could buy, you know, essentials and foods and stuff, things that she couldn't buy. One of the things that she was working her way out of was buying coffee at takeout places, any takeout coffee, because it can be so expensive. And so she switched to that. And it was an interesting book. And actually, I've listened to interviews with the author since, and she has kind of a complicated history and relationship with the book, because a lot of people have started to view her as the, you know, simplicity guru, stripped down thing. And it's easy to kind of like get hung up on the practice and miss the underlying principles, right? It's not about being religious and aggressive and stripping your life down to the bare essentials and living like a monk. You know, that's great. Maybe life is asking you to do that in a season, but that's not what it's about. She writes this in the closing chapter, and I'll use this to kind of, close. She says, one of the greatest lessons I learned during these years is that whenever you're thinking of binging, it's usually because some part of you or your life feels like it's lacking, which is something you could just sit and think with there for a second, but nothing you drink, eat, or buy can fix it. Instead, she writes, you have to simplify. You have to strip things away and figure out what's really going on. Falling into the cycle of wanting more, consuming more, and needing even more won't help. More was never the answer. the answer, it turned out, was always less. So my hope for you and for me is that we can approach our lives with curiosity and examine what things in our life is calling to us to simplify, what parts of our life are speaking to us and asking us to remove friction. And as we do, we can become more comfortable with the silence. Allow that silence to become the fertile ground from which growth happens.